Okay, well, thank you. Welcome back. We're here for elimination of bias today. Whenever we start the elimination of bias program, you've probably been to others, I'm sure sometimes you walk out of those elimination of bias programs thinking to yourselves that, that person, they were just maybe a little bit on the patronizing side, or maybe just a little bit on the self-righteous side, telling you that you were biased and impliedly saying that the presenter is not biased. I'll start out by saying two things. One is that I'm not any more of an expert on the subject of elimination of bias than any of you are. I'm just an attorney in Minnesota, so I don't have any particular expertise in the area of elimination of bias, other than I've been in the CLE business for a few years, and that's one of the categories that you need to have. So I put together this program. And the only expertise that I have on the elimination of bias is from putting this program together. Although I've actually learned quite a lot over the last few years on the subject of elimination of bias, and that mostly comes from other attorneys that I've given the program to. So I welcome any insights or input that you might have. The first time I gave the program, I was hard pressed to fill up an hour talking about the topic, and now, thanks to comments I've received from other attorneys who've taken it, I don't have much difficulty filling up 2 hours. So we'll talk about that. So that's my first admission. I'm not necessarily an expert on the subject. And my second admission is that I'm just as biased as all of you. I don't purport to be a totally unbiased person because I've, especially from giving this program over the years, I realize that that I probably do have a lot of biases. I guess the third admission I'm going to make is that I'm probably not going to eliminate anybody's bias today. Despite the title of the program, Elimination of Bias, I think that's a pretty unachievable goal to actually eliminate anybody's bias before we leave today. But I think what we will be able to do is recognize some of the biases that we have be able to deal with them a little bit better. We have to be here for the next 2 hours because the Minnesota Supreme Court said we had to be here talking about elimination of bias. So I guess it's best to make the best of that situation, try to recognize what our biases are, maybe eliminate some of them. And in the process, make ourselves a little bit better attorneys, a little bit better able to deal with our clients and the other people we encounter in the practice of law. A couple of things to prove that I am indeed biased, a couple of incidents that came up recently. Number one, just to show how often these kinds of issues come up, let's look around the room. How many people here are in a wheelchair? I see there are none of them. If there had been one, we would have had a big problem today because, as you noticed when you were coming in here, there was a stairway that you had to navigate. So this program was biased against people with mobility issues that can't navigate a flight of stairs. I realized, I'm biased. We are here in this room that is inaccessible, but I did recognize that bias. So I put on the website that, I'm sorry, in this case, this room is not accessible. If that's an issue, please contact me and we will make alternate arrangements, which probably would have been having to scramble at the last minute trying to find a suitable alternate facility. And I know Bill has mentioned that he has kind of an arrangement with the landlord that when those situations come up, because obviously if you do personal injury work, occasionally you're going to have people with mobility issues. And he has a conference room that he has available on the ground floor of the building. So it's one case where that comes up. So I guess one case where I'm guilty of bias. A recent case where I was accused of bias, and maybe correctly so, I don't know. A few weeks ago, we had another CLE program, and like many of you, I advertised it by sending out a postcard to local attorneys, and I got an email back from one of them saying, well, I received this postcard about your program. Unfortunately, I will not be able to attend because I noticed that all of the speakers on this topic were males, and despite the qualified females knowledgeable in this area of the law, you didn't have any of them, so therefore I will be unable to attend.
So that sounds like you're biased.
I don't know. I don't know exactly what was going on.
Well, you're biased thinking assuming it's a woman.
Well, yeah, so I don't know exactly what her issue was. But on the other hand, you know, she didn't have the best social skills in presenting that issue to me, perhaps. In fact, I said, well, you know, I'm sorry, those are just, you know, somebody else put this part of the program together and they're doing it and they both happen to be male. But I invited her, you know, I'm always looking for people to present programs, and if there's any area that you would like to present, I would really enjoy having you. I didn't hear back from her after that. But on the other hand, it was an area of law, kind of an arcane but growing area. It turns out there was a lot of interest in microbrewery law. The people I had speaking on the subject all happened to be male because they were one law firm that dealt with that issue. But as she pointed out, there were many qualified women who were also active in that particular area of the law. I was at another CLE on the same topic over at Hamlin Mitchell a few weeks prior to that. And of the panel of a half a dozen people, I think there were at least a couple of women on that panel. You know, so I got to thinking that, well, you know, to a certain extent, she probably had a point, because you know, if you come into a program, if you're a woman, or if you're an African American, or if you're a person with a disability. And there's never anybody up on the stage that reflects your point of view, that could very well convey the image that, well, brewery and distillery law, that's a topic that the men handle. We don't welcome women into that field of law, which is certainly not true, I don't think, knowing the attorneys who presented that program. But you know, it conveys, I can see how it could convey that impression. So that is the kind of thing that we as attorneys have to be mindful of. A couple of recent experiences that came up. Like I say, when I initially started putting this program together a few years ago, I really had no clue what I was supposed to do other than, you know, attorneys in Minnesota needed 2 credits of elimination of bias. So I had to put together something. So the first place I looked is, well, what are the rules specifically covering bias for attorneys in Minnesota? And I found a couple of them. First of all, in the rules of practice for the district courts. So in other words, dealing with the times when you're in court, either as an attorney or as a judge, there's a rule governing the situation. It says you have to be the judge has to be courteous, respectful, and considerate. Attorneys, you don't have to be dignified, courteous, and respectful. That's generally a good idea. But you have to treat everybody fairly, either as the a judge or the attorney, and specifically, you have to treat all parties, participants, other lawyers, court personnel fairly. And when you're in court, you may not discriminate against anybody. Court staff, other witnesses, anybody. You can never discriminate on the basis of race, color, creed, religion, national origin, sex, marital status, sexual preference, status with regard to public assistance, disability, or age. So if you're actually in court, the subject of elimination of bias is not just a feel-good topic that we need to talk about, but it's an actual requirement. You have to, the rules say that you must be unbiased against everybody in the courtroom when you're in court. Well, and even when you're not in court, when you're engaged in the practice of law, or even possibly in your professional life, it's professional misconduct under the ethics rules to harass anybody on the grounds of their sex, race, age, and any of those other categories. You can't harass people. You can't harass people in connection with your professional activities. So I guess under that rule, it would be okay to harass people in your private life, although that's you shouldn't do that either. But even in your private life, it's professional misconduct if you commit a discriminatory act prohibited by any federal, state, or local law. So if you own rental housing and you discriminate based upon race in housing, you could theoretically get disbarred for doing that, even though it has absolutely nothing to do with the practice of law. Although the whether or not it's in connection with your practice of law is one factor to consider. So I just like to point those out, those rules governing the topic, just to remind us that, there are actual rules about it. It's not just a topic we just have to sit around and feel good about and try to make ourselves feel better about ourselves. No, there's some actual rules saying that you can't discriminate, you can't be biased against other people. So it, to a certain extent, what we are talking about today is hard law that we have to deal with. And there is also one other rule that's not quoted in the materials, but I'm sure you are all familiar with it. And that is, there's a law that says you need to get 2 hours of CLE on the subject of elimination of bias. And surprisingly, most people who take this course are here for one reason alone, and that's to get their 2 credits of elimination of bias taken care of. So you're probably already familiar with that rule. So we'll start by talking a little bit about the history of that rule. Why do we have that? We have that rule in Minnesota. A few other states have a similar rule. I think California has one. Somebody was telling me that they were going to use this course for Florida credit. So there are a handful of states that require a certain amount of elimination of bias or a certain something by that name. But it's kind of unique to the nation. That's why it's kind of, especially for out-of-state attorneys, it can be kind of a challenge. When they need to report their Minnesota CLE, and they're working in New York, where you don't have any elimination of bias CLEs in New York because they don't have that state requirement. So that can sometimes be a little bit of a challenge for them. But why do we in Minnesota have this? Just because we're smarter than everybody else, or we're less biased than everybody else, or why is that? And it turns out we're not less biased than everybody else. That's one thing I figured out that we'll talk about here in a little while. But that requirement actually dates back to about 1993, when the Minnesota Supreme Court decided to take a look at bias in the Minnesota court system. So about 23 years ago or so, they decided to take a look at, is there bias in the Minnesota court system? And to do that, what they did is they held hearings throughout the state. They appointed a committee headed up by then Justice Rosalie Wall of the Minnesota Supreme Court, who just passed away a couple of years ago. They held hearings throughout the state where they just kind of went out in kind of an open-ended fashion and asked members of the community, tell us about your experiences with bias in the Minnesota court system. Perhaps to some people's surprise, probably not to the surprise of others, they did hear reports of, yes, we think there is bias in the Minnesota court system, based upon people's race, based upon people's gender, based upon their English ability. And they heard a lot of stories from around the state about bias in the Minnesota court system. They prepared a report, which is available on the court's website. And I realized when I printed these materials here, it says full reports of these sessions can be found at the commission's website. And there's a big blank where I realized I printed it in black and white, and that was a blue hyperlink there. So I will have the online version of this available, so if you want to see that report. But otherwise, if you just go to Google and type 1993, Task Force on Racial Bias in the Courts, you can find that report. Or send me an email if you want the link. I can send it to you. They put together a 355-page report detailing their findings of bias in the Minnesota court system. At some point, that got put online. But that 355-page report got filed away, and their work was done. Well, obviously, creating a 355-page report does not mean that their work is done. There is bias in the court system. So I encourage you to look at that. I've never sat down and read all 355 pages of it, but you can find that report. You can look at it. And When I looked at it, two things stood out for me. Number one is you look at some of the problems that they've identified in that 1993 report, and the reaction is, well, we can all give ourselves a pat on the back, because that problem that they had back in 1993, that problem is solved. We don't have to worry about that one anymore. And there are a few instances where we can say that. Unfortunately, though, we can't say that most of the time. The main thing that stood out to me when I looked at this 1993 report was that most of the things identified in there, that report could have just as easily been written in 2016 as in 1993, because many of those things. Some are probably impossible to solve. There's only so much you can do. So some probably come under the category of insoluble problems. Many of them, though, are probably just in the category of difficult problems that we have to solve. When this elimination of bias requirement initially came out in the wake of that report in the 1990s, I guess I would probably put myself in the category of being the skeptic, saying, if the Minnesota Supreme Court had come to me in 1993 and said, do you think there's bias in the Minnesota court system? I would have said, well, you can save yourself a lot of time. You don't have to write a 355-page report. You don't have to have any hearings throughout the state. Because no, there's no bias in the Minnesota court system. Everything around here is fair. So I think I probably would have been in that category. Unfortunately, they didn't sit down and ask me for my opinion to tell them that, nah, we don't have to worry about it. There's no bias. There's nothing to see here. So let's move on to other things. Let's have those two extra credits on Minnesota no fault. Rather than worrying about elimination of bias. So I think I probably pretty clearly would have been in the skeptical camp. Because I look at myself, and I look at all of you, and I look at most of the lawyers in the state, and I don't know any maliciously biased attorneys. I don't know any racist lawyers. I don't know any racist judges. I'm sure there's one or two out there somewhere, but for the most part, everybody that I've ever encountered in the Minnesota court system has been a fair-minded person, no overt biases of any kind, and I still believe that's true. I don't think there are too many of these malicious bad guys out there who are being racist and sexist for its own sake, just because they're evil or anything like that.
Well, I mean, I don't think you have to be overtly evil to be biased, and to have your bias, you know, have a detrimental impact on either the counsel or the client, or, you know, that's being, you know, that some impartial observer might believe is being unduly discriminated.
Yeah, well, let me
give you an example.
Yeah.
I mean, I actually remember going to a COA seminar, and I don't remember the name of the attorney, but she's a fairly prominent personal injury litigation attorney. She was telling me about how she had a case that came to trial up in St. Cloud, and she had just given birth a few months ago to a little baby. And so she was breastfeeding the baby. So she told the judge that she was going to have these recesses at least every hour or a couple hours. And she said, boy, she got a very negative reaction from this judge. And he was like, well, couldn't you bottle fed your baby, or just something, you know, it was pretty gross. I mean, it was just, you know, like no empathy whatsoever. And she just told this judge, she said, I don't know exactly what her words were, but she made it clear that she told this judge that, well, that was not an option, and she was the one that had prepared for this trial. There was nobody else in this firm that was going to be able to do this trial. It would be a disservice to the client to have to postpone the trial. And so you've got to accommodate. And she said, well, he kind of grudgingly said, well, okay, we'll go along with it. I don't know exactly what he said, but she wasn't very happy. He wasn't very happy. But I mean, I think that's a clear instance of where that sort of demeanor on the part of the judge, I mean, I think she probably could have actually filed a motion to have the judge removed from the case. So yeah, that's just an example of where it's not like somebody getting up there and making just some totally off the wall statement, but it's pretty evident, I think, that there is a bias there.
Yeah, well, it's good news and bad news, because it's good news that there's not anybody who's overtly biased, but the bad news is if there were these handful of racist judges and sexist lawyers and these malicious people, well, then elimination of bias would be the easiest problem in the world to solve. All you have to do is identify the biased judges and the biased lawyers and just get rid of them, and then the problem is solved. So you know, that makes it a very easy problem to solve. So when I say there's no maliciously biased people out there, we can't take that as good news, because it's actually bad news. It means that the problem is very difficult to solve, because who are the biased people? Well, we all are, including me, including everybody here. So, like I say, as soon as we can identify what those biases are, the judge in that particular case had probably never given the matter much thought until it was presented to him one day, maybe if he had given it more advanced thought before the issue presented itself, maybe it could have been handled in a little bit better manner. That, I think, is why the Minnesota Supreme Court said we have to be here for these 2 hours, so that we can have the opportunity to think about that. And in fact, that was really, I think, the main outcome of this 1993 requirement, or the 1993 task force on racial bias in the courts. I think the main outcome that came from that was the addition of the requirement that we do have to have our 2 hours of elimination of bias. Now, if you're like me, you might you've been to other elimination of bias programs, and sometimes you walk out trying to, kind of scratching your head, you know, well, what exactly did that have to do with bias? What exactly are we supposed to do during these 2 hours? And you actually have to kind of dig pretty deeply. It's not actually even stated in the rule. You have to dig on the Minnesota Board of CLE website to find out exactly what the requirements are for elimination of bias programs. And there are three permitted topics, three things we can talk about. One of them we'll probably be touching on during the course of the program, but we're not concentrating on that. And that is, it would be acceptable to have a program where we talked about ways of eliminating barriers to employment in the legal profession for people because of their race or because of their gender or because of some of these other categories. So if we had a program talking about elimination of barriers to employment in the legal profession, that would have been an acceptable topic. But the other two categories are, first of all, talking about that 1993 report. So that's kind of specifically what we're supposed to talk about, not just the 1993 report, but some of the subsequent reports that we'll talk about. So if we sat down for 2 hours and today we're going to look at pages 1 through 82 of the 1993 report, that would be an acceptable topic, or these subsequent reports that we're actually going to be talking a little bit more about, and basically the subject matter addressed by those reports, namely, what can we do to eliminate bias in the court system? The Minnesota Supreme Court did two things. First of all, they added the requirement for our 2 hours of elimination of bias. And then they also continued this task force that had been created in 1993 and kind of gave it a permanent status. Initially, it was called the Implementation Committee on Multicultural Diversity and Racial Fairness in the Courts. They created that committee. They realized that that name was kind of a mouthful, and they've changed the name a couple of times over the years to first to the Racial Fairness Committee, and most recently in the last couple of years they changed the name of that committee to, as you see in my materials here, that committee is now known as the, and I had a hyperlink to the new committee's website, which is in blue, so it didn't get printed here, so I can't actually tell you the name of the committee. But it's something similar to the Racial Fairness Committee, or Committee on the Elimination of Bias in the Minnesota Courts. But anyway, that committee does continue to exist, and their activities have been primarily continuing this process of holding hearings, of having listening sessions throughout the state, where they go out and talk to members of the community, in just kind of an open-ended fashion, and ask members of the community, tell us about your experiences with bias in the Minnesota court system. And based upon those meetings, they prepare reports, just kind of listing in an open-ended fashion the concerns that have come up from the members of the community. We're going to be spending the bulk of our time today talking about those reports, talking about what members of the community have said when asked the question, what can lawyers, what can judges, what can court staff do better to be less biased and to make the system more fair for us? And as we go through these, some of them, I mean, many of these issues that come up, I think it's fair to say that these issues come up and we'll say, well, no, these people are wrong. They think that this kind of bias exists, but I can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt that they're wrong. That's not the way things work. in the system. So these people are just wrong. And there are some of them that I think we can pretty clearly fit in that category and say, well, no, I'm not going to pay any attention to what these people say because they're clearly wrong. But even in those situations, even if we look at some of these concerns that members of the public have about the court system, well, it seems to me even the ones where they are wrong is a concern to us for two reasons. First of all, even if there's not an actual bias there, there's at least a perception of bias that we have to worry about. And to a large extent, it seems to me that the perception of bias is really just as bad as the actual bias itself. Because, we as attorneys are invested in the court system. We are invested in a system that is fair. If our clients need redress of grievances, they have a place to go. Well, that only works if it's more or less universally believed that the system that you're getting your redress of grievances from is fair. If large members of the population start to believe, rightly or wrongly, that they're not going to get a fair shake if they go to court or if they resort to the legal system, well, then they're going to start resorting to other systems, number one, as citizens, we should be concerned about that because I think we have a responsibility to believe in the rule of law, and we want to have the rule of law prevail in this country. And that only works if most of the people think that the law is ruling them fairly, and they'll depart from it. And just from a purely selfish point of view. We as attorneys want, if people resort to things other than the legal system to redress their grievances, well, then we're kind of out of a job. So we want the whole system to be perceived as fair. So even in these situations where we're going to identify some of these areas where this bias is not a true bias, well, we still want to be, we still should worry about that a little bit because of that perception of bias. And also, it probably goes to show a situation where we as public citizens can maybe do a little bit better job in educating people how things really work. So I think it's important to know those situations, even the ones that are wrong. And unfortunately, some of these topics that we're going to talk about today that have been identified by the public, some of them we can say that no, these people are wrong. That bias doesn't exist. On the other hand, there's some of them we can look at, and even the cynic like me will eventually come to the conclusion that people are saying this in every corner of the state of Minnesota, that thing X is broken with the system. Eventually, you hear that enough, you start to think, maybe they're right. Maybe this part of the system is broken. So we have to be open to the fact that some of these perceptions of unfairness in the system might be actual unfairness. At this point, for those of you listening on the webcast, I'm going to give the first code number of several code numbers I'm going to give during today's program, and that number is B318. B as in bias, 318. B318 is the first code number. So those of you here live, you don't have to worry about writing that down, but those of you listening on the podcast, you'll need to email that code number to me at the end of the program. Not if you're in traffic, though. If you're in heavy traffic, just write it down. And also, if you missed it, I'm not heartless. So if you send me an email saying that, I got three of the code numbers, but I missed the first one, well, I'll probably let that slip. Now, if you send me an email saying you didn't hear any of them, that might be a different matter. But do your best to get those code numbers to me to prove that you actually attended. So like I say, the main part of the program we're going to talk about is what were some of the things that were said at these listening sessions? And these have been held all over the state. I recently updated the materials because they're still doing this. The last time I updated these materials was about 3 years ago, and in the intervening time, they held a few more of these listening sessions, mostly in the Twin Cities metro area, the most recent ones. I believe there was one in North Minneapolis, I've just kind of grouped the listening sessions that they've held over the years, tried to put the comments that they made into like categories, tried to group them together. The main thing that I noticed was that no matter where these sessions were, a lot of the same issues kept coming up over and over. Most of them were in the Twin Cities area. Some of them were held outstate. One thing I noticed by looking at these listening sessions, it occurred to me that one thing that really has changed since 1993, like I say, that 1993 report could have been written, any time. Not too much has changed. But the one thing that I noticed was kind of a big change, and it also made me realize that there's one thing unique about Minnesota that I've never really noticed too much in other states, and that is that I think in 1993, the lawyer in Rochester or Mankato or Duluth, who was for the first time forced to take an elimination of bias course, I think that lawyer probably would have had a pretty strong argument of saying, why should I have to sit through 2 hours of elimination of bias? Because we don't have anybody around here to be biased against. Everybody looks exactly the same. And in 1993, or at least, maybe things were starting to change then, I think there was a certain amount of truth to that. Because one thing I've discovered about Minnesota that I never really noticed is, unlike most other states, the minority population in Minnesota has pretty much been concentrated in the Twin City metro area. There has never been much of a, for example, African American population in outstate Minnesota. People in Duluth or Mankato or Rochester, they were never biased against African Americans because, for the most part, there weren't any. Now, you might have an exception.
Well, I think there are lots of exceptions. I mean, if you consider gender bias,
yeah,
or age bias, or sexual orientation bias, or even ethnic origin bias. I mean,
right. Norwegians and Swedes, they've been at it for a long time.
I mean, all these biases throughout the state.
Well, and there's also one large category of the population that was kind of ignored in 1993 that actually was outstate, namely Native Americans.
Yeah, sure.
They didn't talk about that too much because, yeah, there weren't any black people in Duluth. Well, I mean, there were always a few, but there certainly were Native Americans. The Rochester or Mankato attorney saying, I don't have to worry about discrimination because I don't have anybody to discriminate against, well, probably wasn't 100% true, as you point out, but it's certainly no longer true. So even if some outstate attorney had that objection in 1993, that's certainly not the case, because that's one thing that has really changed, I've noticed over the year. Because, for example, and what kind of drove that home to me is they held one of these listening sessions in Rochester. And the listening session in Rochester was made up of members of the Somali community. Well, I don't think there was a Somali community in Rochester, Minnesota in 1993, but there certainly is now. So that is a big change over the years. So even for the attorneys outside the Twin Cities area who might have been able to get away with saying, we don't have any biases here because we have nobody against whom to be biased. Well, if they, even if they could say that in 1993, and I think you're probably right, they probably couldn't. But even if they could say it back then, they can't say it anymore. But to the extent that they could say it before, it never occurred to me, but that's kind of a unique thing in Minnesota. Minnesota has never had an outstate African-American population. Certainly there will be, a handful of exceptions, but the in 1990 or whatever, the African-American population of Duluth was, in the dozens or whatever. It was just not a large group there. And I had always kind of grown up assuming that that's the way it was everywhere. Well, it's not the way it was everywhere. Even as close as Iowa, I was doing a CLE in Mason City. So Mason City, Iowa. You think of that. That's probably about the same size as Mankato, Minnesota. Within fairly close distance. So you think of it as it's probably pretty much the same as any. As a Minnesota town of the same size. Well, it's not in that respect because, for example, in Mason City, Iowa, there has always been an African-American population. I never realized that until one of the attorneys taking the program down there, he was recounting a story. He was an older attorney, so he went to high school in like the 1950s or so. And he was recounting a story about when he was on the high school football team and there was an African-American player on the high school football team. There was no segregation in Iowa, but they were on Nebraska. They were playing a game in Nebraska. So he was in the situation where the African-American player on his football team was not allowed to stay in the same hotel. And I forget how they resolved that, whether they grudgingly put up with it or not. But two remarkable things. One is that in this attorney's lifetime here in the Midwest, they had to deal with segregation. That was probably the most remarkable thing. But the other thing that it occurred to me that there was an African-American student at the Mason City High School. I don't think that there were any African-American students at most rural Minnesota high schools in the 1950s. So we do have a little bit of a different culture in Minnesota, so maybe we do need it more than attorneys in other states. One African-American attorney I was working with, he was from somewhere else, and he had lived all over the place in the southern U.S. and in the east. His comment to me was that racism was worse, the worst racism he has ever encountered is here in Minnesota. And the reason why he said that is not because we're any more evil or we're any more bigoted than anybody else, but we just don't believe that we're racist. So, in other words, if he's dealing with somebody in somewhere in the South, and that person is proudly racist, and they admit it, and they wear it on their sleeve, in many ways that's a lot easier to deal with than somebody. Who might have the same biases as that other person, but just doesn't realize it. So again, I don't know if whether it's 100% true, but like I say, his reaction was that as far as racism concerned, in some ways Minnesota is the worst. Another difference between the states, before I get back on track, is I had an African American attorney from. He was in Milwaukee, he was married to his wife was from somewhere else. One of them was from the Twin Cities, one of them was from some other state, and I forget which one was which. But he pointed out, and from being married to somebody from another state, it was very, very obvious to him, was that in Milwaukee, where he lived now, and in the 1950s and 1960s, there were, for example, African American doctors and African American lawyers, and there were people in that category. There was certainly discrimination, but there were professionals in those categories. In Minnesota, there weren't. So there is something different about Minnesota. Now, the exception that proves the rule is that the has anybody in this room ever heard of J. Frank Wheaton? I didn't think so. J. Frank Wheaton was the first African American legislator who served in the Minnesota legislature. He was elected in, I think, 1898, or he was serving right around the turn of the century. So he was, I forget whether he was elected in 98 or in 1900. But he was the first African American legislature. He represented Southwest Minneapolis, a district, a wealthy white district. He was, African Americans were certainly a minority in the population. So I like to throw that out there as some forgotten history. It's possibly forgotten because he's a Republican, and so it doesn't the Republicans necessarily match with their view of history. For non-Republicans, it certainly doesn't match their view of history. But he was the first African American legislator, and actually passed. He was a sponsor of civil rights legislation, which basically used the basically the same language as used in federal legislation in the 60s. So it prohibited discrimination in places of public accommodation, restaurants and hotels and so forth. That's been against the law in Minnesota since about 1900. Sometimes our perceptions of history can be wrong. But anyway, getting back to these listening sessions after our long prelude here. Let's see. What time is it, Bill?
I've got 10 after 12.
Okay, we'll go for about another 20 minutes or so, then we'll take a break. Getting back to these listening sessions, what I did is I just kind of grouped these comments together that were heard in different parts of the state. We'll just look at some of the comments that were made at some of these listening sessions. And I didn't put them in any particular order other than the first category I put first just because I think it's kind of a good summary of what is to come. Many of these listening sessions, the comment that people made is that there needs to be more education and training for people to be more courteous, compassionate, understanding, tolerant, and humble about racial and societal differences. So that was kind of universally realized that we need greater education, we need more understanding of racial and cultural differences. And I think it's a really really interesting that the word humble was used in some of those. So the comment was, lawyers and judges need to be more humble when you're dealing with people of different backgrounds. Now, I guess if I want to hire an attorney, if I need an attorney to represent me, I get into a car accident, so I walk into Bill's office, and I say I need an attorney. Now the main skill I want from you is humility. Well, no, I don't think that we should turn it all around to say that we want to be humble all the time. So don't walk out of the room thinking I'm going to go into court looking meek and humble. That will somehow help things, because I want my lawyer to be aggressive, and I probably don't want the judge hearing my case to be humble. I want him to be him or her to be a decisive person. But I think it's still interesting that I think humility is maybe one. this is kind of, talk about mixed metaphors, humility is one weapon that we should have in our quiver. I think humility can go a long way in a lot of situations. And one anecdote that kind of drove that home is that one of the listening sessions that was held in Hinckley, that was made up mostly of members of the Mille Lacs Ojibwe, talking about their experiences. One of the elders of the tribe was telling about a situation where one of the members of the band is one of these people. There's a certain group of people that make life difficult for the police officers of the world. The guy is not necessarily committing too many crimes, but he's just one of these people who's always having negative contacts with law enforcement. Whenever law enforcement has to deal with this person, it's always a tense situation, tempers are ready to flare. And it's always a problem. So one of the a Pine County Sheriff's deputy was, commiserating about this guy that he had to deal with all the time. That was always bad news. Whenever we run into so and so, it's always a tense situation, and he's always being a jerk. And I wish we didn't have to deal with him. He makes our job a lot more difficult. So this tribal elder listened and made the suggestion to this gruff police officer, because I don't want our cops to be humble either. I want our cops to be, if you're going to be a cop, you have to be a little bit aggressive. You can't just be meek and mild all the time. So he told this gruff deputy in Pine County that, I tell you what, next time you see this guy, try this. The next time you run across this gentleman, you just say to him, Anin Buzu, which is just the Ojibwe language, which I'm sure I butchered, and I'm sure the deputy butchered it, but it just means hello in the Ojibwe language. So this deputy grudgingly said, okay, well, I'll give that a try. It's not going to do any good. So the next contact he had with Mr. Trouble, instead of roughing him up or whatever, he said, Anin Buzu. Well, the deputy reported back that made a world of difference. That tiny little step of, making, just saying a couple of words in somebody else's language. In my own practice, I remember I had a personal injury client a long time ago, and he was a Middle Eastern person. And I'm not revealing anything confidential by saying what his first name is, because it was a very common first name. It would be like me saying, I had a client named John. Well, that doesn't say anything. But his first name was it was spelled EID, is how his first name was spelled. And he was relatively new to the country. He hadn't been around for a long time. And he was injured in this accident, and he had all kinds of legal problems after his short stay in the country. So he came into my office, and I shook hands with him, and I said, "Hello, Aid." And he practically fell out of his chair because he was so surprised that I was the first American who had said his name right. And it was partly just, sheer luck, because I looked at this, EID, and I guessed, he's not an American. It's probably not pronounced the same way we pronounce it in American. So I'm just going to guess and say that it's two syllables, because there are two vowels. And I guessed right. But I was the first American who had ever said his name right in all the time he'd been here, because until that time, everybody had called him Ide, and they, for all I know, they probably still call him Ide to this day. But I was the first American who had ever said his name right, and it was like an incredible bond he had with me after that, because it was just this incredible trust. And I think it was just a matter of I got lucky, and said his name right the first time I heard it. So like I say, I don't want any of you to walk out of here saying that, thinking that you have to be humble all the time, and dispense with your aggressive nature as attorneys. But on the other hand, we have to keep in mind that sometimes humility can really go a long way to bridge those cultural gaps. So even if you say Anin Buzu and totally mispronounce it, or say Buenos Dias and totally botch that pronunciation, sometimes just that tiny gesture can really make a difference. That's certainly, we have to do more than just that. But sometimes those tiny gestures of showing that vulnerability of pronouncing it wrong, that can really go a long way. So, like I say, that's the first category I put here from some of the remarks. And in your you can read the remarks, the particular ones made, different listening sessions, if you want to read those at your leisure. The next category that came up in many cases came under the category of litigants not understanding court proceedings. And a few subcategories of that. Now, when you look through these comments, you will see that some of them have absolutely nothing whatsoever to do with bias. I'm a lawyer, and one day I got a parking ticket because my license tabs were expired or something, I don't remember. I had to go into court. And it can be intimidating, even though I sometimes go into court as the attorney. Standing in that line with the public, I have to get up to the counter just like everybody else and ask questions and figure out what to do. And it turns out if you have expired license plates in Ramsey County, what you have to do is, first of all, obviously the very first thing I did was went and got the license tabs. But it turns out in Ramsey County, if you have expired license tabs, what you have to do is you have to put the tabs on there, and then you have to take a picture of your license plate. And you can't just take it on your smartphone and show it to them. Then you have to print the picture of your license plate with the new sticker, and then you have to walk up to the counter, probably with a sense of humility, and show the guy your picture, and then they'll say that, well, if you really got them, we'll check it out, but we'll throw the ticket out if you really did that. So it's not just a case because of people's cultural background or race or anything not understanding court proceedings. Sometimes you don't understand the court proceedings just because it's a kind of an arcane system. And even as an attorney, that sounds like a pretty silly system to enforce the license plate laws in the state. And I certainly didn't understand the need to take a picture of my license plates and show it to the guy behind the counter. So we could easily dismiss this and say, well, most of these things were people not understanding the court system. That has absolutely nothing to do with bias, so we don't have to worry about that. That's not a proper topic to talk about in elimination of bias. But on the other hand, it is for a couple of reasons. One is there's at least a perception of bias. Now, when I walked in there with the photo of my license plate to hand to the guy behind the counter, I just thought this was silly or whatever. If I was from a different country, or if the color of my skin were different, I could certainly see, thinking to myself, I bet they don't do that to everybody, make them go through that silly process. Turns out they would be wrong, that everybody has to go through that same silly process. So even if it's just a perception, and even if that perception is wrong, that's one we have to worry about. So there was a lot of thinking there that litigants don't understand court proceedings. But many times, of course, that flows from language differences or cultural differences, why people don't understand court proceedings. Now, the subject of interpreters is actually a different topic. It's elsewhere in your materials. Maybe we'll get back to that again, too. But the one of the areas that was identified in the 1993 proceedings was the lack of interpreters, or the need for interpreters, an unmet need for interpreters in the court system. And at least in the criminal context, and probably in the civil context, if you pay for it, that's one area where we can probably pat ourselves on the back and say, no, we've solved that problem. The actual numerical availability of interpreters. If you go into court and you need an interpreter, chances are you're going to be able to find an there will be one available. There might be some burdens that it places on you. But that's an area where I think since 1993 we actually have solved, because there's certification for interpreters. The courts are aware of that need. On the other hand, though, it's not entirely solved, because where the interpreter problem is solved is certainly if you have a jury trial or a court trial. If you have a formal trial, you are certainly going to get an interpreter if you need one. There might be some exceptions. There might be some cases where the interpreter is no good or something. But in general, if you have to be in court and you don't understand the language, there will be somebody there to translate for you to make sure that you understand the language. So if I get a parking ticket for having expired tabs on my car, and I demand a trial, well, I will certainly get a trial, and I will certainly get an interpreter to tell me what's going on. But that's not a very efficient use of resources, because we don't want every parking ticket going to trial. Where there still is a need for interpreters that's identified quite readily is for those informal interactions that go on. So, in other words, when I walk up to the counter, not speaking English, saying, you know, I got this ticket, what do I do? And the person behind the counter is trying to explain to me that I need to go take a photograph of my license plates and bring the photograph in, and then wait 2 weeks. And because I'm a lawyer, I knew to check online to make sure that the charges really were dismissed, because what I was waiting for was they lost it, and now there's a warrant for me because they didn't actually dismiss them. So I'm glad I'm a lawyer for things like that. But the person with limited English ability who gets up to the counter, probably there's a good chance that they're going to misunderstand the subtleties of those explanations. So the area where we've done really well as a court system in eliminating bias is making sure that there are interpreters in formal proceedings. So if you are a defendant in a criminal case, or probably a litigant in a civil case, or even a witness in some kind of case, in that formal court proceeding, you're almost certainly going to be able to get a qualified interpreter. But on the other hand, you're also more likely to wind up in that formal trial because you were not able to resolve the situation at the window because the person behind the window did not speak the language. And Bill, I know the last time I gave this program, every time I give the program, I learn a little bit more. You gave the example of how Sears across from the state capitol works things. Are they still there? Do they still?
As far as I know.
Okay. They're always talking about closing. But there's a license bureau up on the top floor, and you pointed out that they have that down to an art. They kind of, the way they schedule things, they know there's going to be one Spanish-speaking clerk there and one Somali-speaking clerk. So if you need to renew your driver's license and you walk into Sears, they've done a pretty good job of it. On the other hand, if you walk into the Anoka County Courthouse or the Dakota County Courthouse to pay your property taxes, they might not have somebody behind the counter who can help you with that.
There's just one other little point. I don't know about your experience, but I've had a couple situations where I've had trials, and I had one in particular down on my own account where it was a Laotian woman who didn't speak any English. We hired our own interpreter, and he had lived down in Southeast Minnesota for some years, so and actually his English was quite good. I thought his English was quite good, but I can't prove this verbatim, but I believe that there definitely was jury bias against our client, just because, for one thing, it was, you know, it, like you said, Richard, it does take more time. You know, you got your client that's basically speaking in their native language, and then you got the interpreter speaking in English, and as a practical matter, it becomes more difficult to hold the attention of the jury. And actually, we I won't go into all the details, but we actually had a we had a second trial because basically the judge forgot to give the jury three pages of instructions, and she told the jury, because one of the jurors was taking notes as she was reading the instructions, and she just said to the jury, she says, "Well, you don't have to do that." She said, "You'll be giving all the instructions in writing." And so the woman kept taking notes, and then sure enough, she left out the three pages that had to do with standards of liability. So then I filed a motion for a new trial, and so then the judge issued the order that there would be a new trial, but her rationale for giving the new trial was because she thought the jury was biased. Although, interesting enough, neither of the attorneys for the insurance defense or myself written any arguments alleging jury bias. So then I filed a new motion for a trial to change the venue to Ramsey County, you know, using her argument that these juries were biased against a law person. Well, she rejected that, saying that, well, just because one jury is biased doesn't mean another jury would be biased. I think that the reason she took that tack is because she didn't want to admit that, as I pointed out to her, there's a Supreme Court case in Minnesota that says that judges have discretion as to whether they give oral instructions or written instructions, but you can't give some of each. And that's exactly what she did. And so she was kind of stuck, but she didn't want to admit that she had screwed up. Is what I wanted to do. So she said, well, the fact that I did this was just sort of, you know, it's a harmless oversight or something, you know, that kind of language. She tried to pin it on this biased jury. I don't know if any of you have had that issue.
Well, could you? Can I throw a question?
Sure.
It would be helpful for me and maybe for others if you could give a flavor for who clients are or who folks are that are interacting with the court system who don't speak English. I mean, we all know there are plenty of people in our country who don't speak English. Mm-hmm. Is it folks who came here as immigrants in middle age and therefore find it difficult to learn the language? Is it folks who are here in an undocumented way? And I think we'd want to break that down a bit to address the root.
Okay. Well, I noticed that's a good question. Maybe we should take that up right after the break.
Sure.
Yeah. And let me give the second code word for the first hour of the program. That's B362. As in bias 362, B362, and we will take a break here, and we'll come back for hour two.